WBAI New York, 99.5 FM. Good afternoon. Welcome to Art Breaking. I'm Charlie Finch. Glad to have you with us. My guest today is Myron Schwartzman, professor of English at Bernard Baruch College here in New York, who has written a book about Romery Bearden called Romery Bearden, His Life and Art, published by Harry Abrams. Professor Schwartzman, good to have you with us here today.
Nice to be here, Chuck.
Henry Miller once wrote a book called Remember to Remember, and that phrase very much sums up the life and work of Romery Bearden, from his childhood in Charlotte, later in New York, Pittsburgh. Tell us a little about his origin in the late 19th century.
Well, I think it's important to know about Romery's family that his great-grandfather, Henry B. Kennedy, had come from the, I guess what you would call it, the upper middle class of Charlotte public life. As a matter of fact, on the 50th anniversary of emancipation, Henry B. Kennedy was mentioned as one of Charlotte's most prominent citizens, alongside bishops, lawyers, doctors, and even a man who had been appointed to serve as the United States representative to Sierra Leone, I believe.
He was Bearden's great-grandfather.
This was Bearden's great-grandfather. He never knew his grandfather, Richard Bearden, who had been a blacksmith and harness maker and who had died in the late 1880s. So that for all intents and purposes, his grandfather was his great-grandfather, and he was born in his great-grandfather's house, which was on the corner of a street called Graham Street, or South Graham Street, in Charlotte. And Henry Kennedy was a self-made man who had come to Charlotte by way of the railroads. The railroads were of enormous importance, as you know, at that time. And he had established himself in Charlotte and had become a property owner and owned not only that corner house where Romery was born, but several houses adjacent to it, running down toward a railway trestle. And so Romery was born into this house and solidly into the middle class of Charlotte. And I should also say that at that point in the century, the early 20th century, it was the last days, let's say, of a window that had opened with Reconstruction and lasted until Jim Crow laws and statutes came into effect and the whole thing closed. But for that period, from say 1867 till 1911, there were blacks being elected to political office. They were serving as aldermen. They were prominent citizens of Charlotte, and you know, it was pretty much white living next to black and living together the way we experience life nowadays.
And of course, years later, when you and Romery became friends, Myron, this was a source of his Mecklenburg County series, some of his greatest collage works.
Oh yes, I think that the strongest, it was almost like gravity, the pull of those memories. And as he grew older, I think that the gravitational pull grew stronger and stronger back to his earliest childhood days. I don't know how a child of three could have formed those visual impressions, but he had one, for example, of a tiger lily, an orange and brown and say yellow tiger lily that was growing in his great-grandfather's garden in front of the house. That one day he saw a cut, and he asked his great-grandfather about it, and he was told that his great-grandmother had worn it to church, and not to worry, that it would come back the next year. And I think that kind of visual recollection, which he told Henri Gent in an interview for the Archives of American Art was his one of his earliest visual recollections, that sort of a paradigm of the pull of earliest memory on him, the urge to retrieve it.
Now, his mother, Bessie Bearden, was a great lady in black culture in New York, editor of the Chicago Defender. Tell us a bit about her.
Well, Bessie Bearden was really a woman who deserves a book of her own. She was the first black woman elected to a school board in New York City, for example. Her work for the Chicago Defender was largely society news, and she wrote this regularly, but occasionally she would send Romery or Edward Morrow, with whom Romery lived in her apartment, he was a graduate of Yale, out to a ball game to report, and it would go in under her byline. Also, she was a very good friend of Mary McLeod Bethune and a friend of Eleanor Roosevelt's. Introduced Eleanor Roosevelt at a speech in Harlem, and Romery accompanied the First Lady. It was all, you know, so if you wanted to get anything done in mainstream Harlem Democratic politics, you would see Bessie Bearden.
You tell a wonderful anecdote about Eleanor Roosevelt taking the subway to deliver this speech, how different it is from today's politics.
Oh, yeah, that's true. That's true. But Romer expected that there would be a chauffeured limousine that would pull up in front of the house, and lo and behold, they took the subway.
Romery was quite a pitcher, quite a baseball player. He pitched against Satchel Paige and was even offered a contract by Connie Mack, the manager of the Athletics, if he agreed to pass as white. Tell us how he got interested in art.
Well, I think he was interested in art from the time he was a boy in Pittsburgh, living with his maternal grandmother, a woman named Carrie Banks. Ms. Banks had a boarding house in Pittsburgh, very close to the steel mills, and she boarded the black steel mill workers who had come up from the south to work in the mills, and she would rub them down with cocoa butter. And Romery then came to know, as a boy of 11 or 12, a paralyzed young man named Eugene, whose mother worked in a bordello in Pittsburgh. Eugene drew, and Romery later thought of him as a kind of Lautrec.
He did erotic drawings, didn't he?
He did these erotic drawings of the house in which his mother worked, and he would shear away the facades of the floors. And the outside walls, in much the same way that George Grotz, Bearden's later teacher, would shear away the facades to show grisly scenes of what was going on in 1920s Germany. But Eugene would do these erotic drawings. One, for example, showed a bullet coming down the roof of a whorehouse and passing down floors where women were dancing naked with men, going down from floor to floor, and then ending up in the purse of the madam. And Romery set about learning how to draw from Eugene. Later, when his grandmother saw these drawings, she was outraged, and she did two things. First of all, she got Eugene out of the bordello. She appeared on the doorstep, asked for his mother, and took the boy home with her. And the second thing was that she destroyed all of Romery's drawings. In her house, somehow Eugene wilted and died within 2 years. That may have been a product of his physical debility. But Romery always remembered Eugene, and a collage that he did decades later.
The block.
The block is a kind of memory of that kind of shearing away of the facades of a house to show all kinds of things going on. Actually, it's a block that's paradigmatic of a Harlem block. It It could have been the block, for example, across the street from Lenox Terrace, where Albert Murray, my mentor, lives, where there is a church and houses, other brownstone houses and so on. But for Romery, it was a lot of things. It was, for one thing, a set of piano keys, because if you think of those houses, you see that they're vertically sort of like a piano, and then the facades are sheared away also.
Romery had a rather bizarre patron as a young man in Pittsburgh, a man named Druitt, a KKK enthusiast. Tell us a little about him.
Well, Romy had me cracking up about Mr. Druitt. It seems that Druitt, although he knew that Romery was black because his cousin Charlie, his cousin Errol were darker skinned than he, take out this edition of the Indiana-based KKK Weekly or whatever the hell it was, and show it to Romery and say, this is the real stuff, young man. You better see what's going on in the world. But he employed Romy and trusted him in a resort that he ran at a lake nearby. And Romy tells this story about how one evening, a bunch of automobiles pulled up. It was like something out of The Godfather, but way back then. And some gangsters walked in, held up the place, and Druitt had told Romery that he should pocket the cash from the cash register and leave only enough to make it look like there was something in the register.
$200.
Right, and keep the rest in his pocket. So these guys came up, told everybody to lay down on the floor, finally came round to him and said, "What's in that cash register, boy?" And he said, "Nothing." Meanwhile, he was, of course, shaking in his boots, but he managed to return the cash to Mr. Druitt. The police, who were paid off probably by everybody and who knew better than to enter, came in shortly thereafter, and Druitt was so grateful to the young Romery that he made it possible for him to start college. And Romery got out of Pittsburgh and out of Pennsylvania.
And then he came to New York in the 20s and early 30s. And
after a stint at Boston University, where he was a pitcher for the varsity baseball team and got the offer you mentioned, from Connie Mack, it's told. He came back to New York in 1933 and finished his studies as a mathematics major at NYU.
Tell us about the atmosphere of the Harlem Renaissance, one of the great creative periods in American life, and how Romery came into it as a young man.
Well, Romery came into it by way of some of the great figures of the Harlem Renaissance. Langston Hughes, for one, introduced him to Garcia Lorca and translated for Lorca, whose English was, as Romery told me, was not that good. So he met Lorca, although he had no particular interest in his work in the very early 1930s. Then later on, in the 40s, he of course did a series on Lorca's poem about the bullfighter, the lament for a bullfighter, Ignacio Mejias. And he, by that time, had a translation by Stephen Spender to go by. But he knew Langston Hughes, he knew Duke Ellington, he knew Fats Waller. Fats Waller is lyricist Andy Razoff. He knew County Cullen. All these figures were people who stopped by Bessie Bearden's house, Paul Robeson.
And from this came the emergence of the so-called 306 School on Lenox Avenue, of other artists who were contemporaries of Romery's.
Well, 306 was an address on 141st Street, and something like Stieglitz's that famous address, 306, became the catchword for a group of artists, writers, theater people, sculptors, who gathered in the studios of Bearden's cousin by marriage, Charles Alston. It was a WPA group, and Charles Alston and Mike Banarn, who was a sculptor, had studios there. So did the late Ed Bates's brother, Leonard Bates, have a studio there, and later on, so did Ralph Ellison.
You're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, listener-sponsored radio. I'm Charlie Finch, and this is Art Breaking. We're talking to Myron Schwartzman, professor of English at Baruch College here in New York, and author of the just-published Rummery Bearden, His Life and Art, published by Harry Abrams, Inc. So Bearden did a lot of work as part of the WPA project
for a few years. He was part of it, but he wasn't on the WPA, because by 1938 he had become a caseworker for the welfare department.
His specialty was gypsies.
And later on, in the beginning his caseload was Harlem, but later on his specialty was the very sensitive population in New York, the gypsies of New York City. And I think, since you asked before about Bessie Bearden, that he got his sensitivity and his adroitness, his diplomacy in dealing with people in very sensitive situations, such as those the gypsies were wont to create, he got that from his mother, who had become, by the mid-30s, an adjudicator for the Internal Revenue Service.
She was like a collector, or she would basically resolve disputes for the IRS?
I believe she resolved disputes for the IRS, yes.
One of the great themes in your book is the kind of two-track life that Rummery led. On the one hand, being a central part of black culture in Harlem, but also studying with George Gross, going to the Art Students League. Tell us about his exposure to Picasso, Braque, and other European artists in the 30s.
Well, of course, by the mid-30s, a number of artists, including Gross, had fled Nazi Germany. And the more left they were, like Gross, who was a communist, the sooner they fled, because they would have faced imprisonment and possibly worse had they remained. But then Picasso's Guernica, which was a product of his experience of the Spanish Civil War, was created, and the Surrealists began to come to New York, so that by the late 40s and certainly by the late 30s and certainly into the 40s, he came to know a group of artists, including Miró, who had come to work in his friend Carl Holte's studio in Harlem, up on Lenox Avenue. And so he came under the influence of that school.
Carl Holte was a great influence on him on a personal level.
Oh, I think that on a personal level and on an intellectual level, it was Holte who was responsible for focusing the Cubist aesthetic for Bearden. And later on, it was Albert Murray who encouraged Bearden to take that aesthetic and apply it to his collages.
During the early 30s, Bearden also engaged in some editorial cartooning influenced by George Gross. Tell us about that.
Well, when he was a student at NYU, his mother wished for him to become a physician, and he was in fact a mathematics major and continued to read in mathematics and philosophy throughout his life. He was one of the best read painters one could hope to find anywhere, but he really began to pursue a career in art at NYU. He was the art director of the NYU humor magazine, The Medley, and at the same time, as he was drawing cartoons which looked very much like those that appeared in The New Yorker, he began to draw toward his graduation for the Baltimore Afro-American, and those cartoons were much different. Those, for example, might show a rabid KKK enthusiast with a gun belt around his shoulder and a hat down over his forehead and a bag with a swastika on his shoulder, carrying a musket and in one hand and a lynching rope in the other, with a bunch of crosses back on the hill, with the words Dixie written beneath his big boot, with the caption, "Why stay in Dixie?" I mean, it was that sort of thing. Everybody in the 30s was left. And when he drew for the Baltimore Afro-American, which he did every single week on the editorial page over a two-year period, Bearden could voice his political sentiments much more directly.
Ed Reinhart was also doing political cartooning at that time, as I understand from your book as well.
Yeah, Ed Reinhart and Sam Shaw were the art directors of the of some of the leading periodicals of the day. And as a matter of fact, a great number of cartoonists for The New Yorker drew for those periodicals. And when one of them refused, the others drew his signature work in his signature style just to get him.
Bearden's work had so much to do with jazz. Many of his most familiar collages have to do with jazz. You yourself are a jazz pianist in Larry Rivers' renowned jazz band. Tell us about the Savoy Ballroom, the atmosphere there, and how Bearden experienced it.
Well, I wish that I had the chance to catch some of the bands at the Savoy. But it must have been quite a scene, because this was the great era of jazz and dance, and you had at the Savoy Chick Webb's band with Ella Fitzgerald, and you had Benny Moten's band coming in, which later became the Count Basie Orchestra. For a while, Billie Holiday was singing with Basie.
These bands would battle with each other at the Savoy.
And there would be battles of the bands. And Chick Webb, who was sort of a diminutive, unprepossessing drummer, would lay in wait during the weeknights for the battle, which took place on the weekend. And he would watch the drummer, he would know the band, and then when the time came, he would blow them away.
Was Rumrey quite a dancer himself?
He was very fast on his feet, but I don't know. I imagine as a young man he would have been wont to watch more than dance, although he had a wonderful taste for the female form. I think that he would have been sitting there watching the dancers.
Myron, I think now is the time where we'd like to hear a bit of an interview that you did with Rumrey. Set it up for us before we play the tape.
Okay. What had happened was that in 1983, Rumrey had done a maquette for what was to become a huge mural in the Lawrence Street or Upton subway stop in Baltimore of the metro system, very near Billie Holiday's birthplace. And in the way that he very often asked Al Murray for suggestions as to titles for his work, he asked me, I remember, what I would entitle it. And I couldn't come up with a name, but he wound up with a good one, and I wouldn't be surprised if it was Al's. It was called Baltimore Uproar. And it shows a band that looks very much like the Duke Ellington band, and a singer in the middle, and it occupies the entire arcade. And I had gotten the two Baltimore newspapers at a New York City stand that has out-of-town papers, brought them to Bearden in his studio, on a Tuesday morning and showed him the newspapers and asked him about the reporter's account of the unveiling of this mural in Baltimore, because I knew that Romy had gone down to Baltimore and in doing so had passed Lutherville, which is on the outskirts of Baltimore, a suburb. A place where he had spent some summers as a young boy with his grandmother.
Now we'll listen to the tape of Myron Schwartzman interviewing Romery Bearden.
You used to visit, I take it, your maternal grandfather when you were in Baltimore as a boy?
No, I think they got that wrong. My father's mother. Married to a man in Bearden, and he died, and she remarried a Reverend Cummings, and that's who he was in Baltimore, and also nearby in Lutherville, Maryland. He was a Methodist minister, and he had a parish when I used to visit. I used to come to Baltimore and go out to Lutherville, sometimes stay there on Drewville Avenue. On my father's side.
I see. How old were you then?
I was in public school, 10, 11, 12.
Were you allowed to go out in the evening late enough to catch any music when you were that young?
No, I didn't. People at that time, they had records, but they weren't too fond of playing jazz, you know. A lot of them felt that, especially religious people,
you know. Sure. Sure. Do you have any special memories of Baltimore?
I remember one thing, that the Baltimore Sun was a penny. And I think it was Mencken's paper, H.L. Mencken, I worked with it. And then I went on a boat ride, and Baltimore came from Louisville. It was a church boat ride. A number of boats went out to the Chesapeake Bay. And well, coming back, it was very near docking, and people soon said, well, look at this fish. They're like on fire. It must have been phosphorus fish of some kind. And everybody ran to that side of the boat, and the boat damn near capsized. But it was so near port that they could, it didn't matter. You know, they were docking, or about to dock. But I imagine it was out in Chesapeake Bay, out there, learned to, you know, they had to swim for it. A lot would have been a lot of casualties. Well, it was the same memory that I have, you know, of Lutherville. When I lived out there, I had a lot of memories, because it was not built up as it was now. I remember a lady who made watermelon cake. And our husband was blind and a guitar player, like Lemon Jefferson and these men. And the watermelon cake, there was a number of wealthy people that had big homes out there. If you were the distance that I am to you, you would swear it was a real watermelon. And she said her mother taught her how to do this, and her grandmother had been born in slavery. And these baking pans that she had was made by an old slave blacksmith. You see, and her grandmother used to make it, you know, for the people that that she on the plantation where she was, and I, she took had some kind of flavor making this red batter, and then she cut chocolate and put it in ice water and then cut it into something simulating seeds. That was put in the batter and baked. Then there was a white, that this then went over a kind of a white cake filling. That was over that, and then that was baked. And then the red was baked with some kind of a filling, and then she painted that. Striping of the mouth, and then a kind of transparent icing. And you cut it right down, you know, like you were cutting watermelon, not but straight like this. And you had the slicing, it was like a piece of watermelon. I remember too that they used to have, not barbecues, but they would have church festivals with food. And there was icy streams in those days. Near there, you see it in the summer, fairly deep, maybe 6 feet. And they would wet, they put the watermelons down before so much ice, you see, in these cold streams, maybe overnight. Mm-hmm. And when they came up, you see, they were ice cold, and they cut them. And then the women brought in food. I've never tasted meat like that. The chicken that they had, the cakes and pies. And they would have it on the lawn of the church. And this lady who made these things, who made the watermelon cake, and along Lutherville at that time, they had bushes of blackberries. You see, you could come and pick those. And, but he always had his guitar. And we would ask him, he had a little wagon sometimes delivering these watermelon cakes. And he would come into the crossroads, a lot of folks, and said, who is there? And I would say, Miss Jones, Miss So-and-so. When he said, tell him to wait. I saw him in a dream. And they would get there, and I said, the casket was just so nice. It's just so and everybody, when they saw him coming, they would take off. Yeah, you know what I mean?
You're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM. This is Art Breaking. I'm Charlie Finch. Glad to have you with us. My guest is Myron Schwartzman, professor of English at Bernard Baruch College here in New York. His new book, published by Harry Abrams, is Romery Bearden, His Life and Art. Romery's first big break in terms of a gallery was with the Kootz Gallery. We talked about Carl Holte before, Stuart Davis and others associated with this gallery. Tell us about the artists there and the gallery itself.
Well, I should say that the way he came to the Kootz Gallery was through Caress Crosby, the...
Harry Crosby's widow.
Right. And that's, of course, got its background in Paris, and...
she had a gallery in Washington where...
And she had a gallery called G Place, which was, of course, on G Place in Washington, and she had shown Bearden during the war. When he did manage, despite being in the 372nd, to paint, she had shown Bearden in 1943, and then she showed Bearden very importantly in 1945 when he did a series called The Passion of Christ. Now, after he showed with her, she brought him to New York and introduced him to Samuel Kootz, who was just getting ready to open his gallery. Carl Holte was shown Bearden's work and recommended Bearden to Kootz. He said, take this fellow on. And so Kootz formed his stable, so to speak, of artists, which included the three B's, Byron Brown, William Basiotis, and Bearden. It included Halty, it included Adolf Gottlieb and Robert Motherwell. It was some of the most important artists of the day.
And when Bearden started with a solo show, he was very successful from the beginning with Coots, wasn't he?
He was enormously successful. It was a continuation with different works of that same series, The Passion of Christ. And the Museum of Modern Art purchased one of those works, He Is Arisen, which was the first Bearden purchased by a museum anywhere in the country.
Describe Bearden's technique. He was still painting at this time. It was long before he'd begun the collage technique.
His technique at the time was almost, I guess you could call it, geometric or prismatic. He worked in both watercolor and in oil. I believe, and I think he would have agreed, that he was more successful with his watercolors than with his oils at that time, because it would be some time before he managed to develop the luminescence in his oils that he achieved in his watercolors.
There's a kind of lyrical merging of line in this work.
Oh, yes. You find he will brush on inks. They began with black ink and other soft and muted colors, sometimes in startling juxtapositions in his watercolor work. And the figures are sometimes occupying the entire canvas, sometimes just a few. In the series, The Passion of Christ, there are some very beautiful works. One of them is called He Walks on the Water. Another, as I mentioned, is called He Is Arisen. Another one is called Golgotha, which is owned by the Metropolitan Museum of Art.
And these were influenced by Renaissance Italian painters like Duccio, Tintoretto, and others.
Exactly. I mean, Bearden had set about relearning for himself the entire tradition in art from the Renaissance forward. And in these early series of the mid-1940s to late 1940s, which included the Christ series, the Lorca series, a series based on Rabelais' Gargantua and Pantagruel, and finally the Iliad variations, he really took this as far as it could go for him, and then he reached an impasse.
As in the careers of so many artists, after his initial success, chosen in the Whitney Annual, reviewed in the Times, sale of some of his works, the gallery sort of betrayed him. Tell us how that happened.
Well, that's true. I think that Coots wasn't out to betray anyone. What had happened was that he decided to take a new direction with his gallery, and so he let go of Halty, he let go of Bearden, he let go essentially of the figurative painters, and he kept those who were to become what would be called abstract expressionists later. There was no word.
This was pre-New York School.
This was pre-New York School, exactly. And so in letting go of Halty, he caused Halty great distress because there was a bargain basement sale at Macy's. You could get two Haltys for the price of one and so on. But Bearden had a different arrangement with Coots and so did not suffer the same sort of financial distress by it.
So Coots shipped all this inventory over to a department store and just had it sold at a deep discount.
Right.
And did Bearden...
Byron Brown also, I should say, sorry to interrupt, but Byron Brown later, I don't know whether because of this, but had a heart attack, and it really hurt these men to lose their affiliation with the Coots Gallery.
Didn't, in fact, Bearden move to Paris and give up painting for a while?
Yeah. After some years, for Bearden, the effect was salutary. Bearden decided to make use of his privileges under the GI Bill of Rights and applied to study at the Sorbonne. And he wound up being accepted at the Sorbonne by a philosopher whose works have now finally come into prominence, Gaston Bachelard.
At this point, Bearden was a man in his mid or late 40s.
That's right. And so he was a mature man and a mature painter who had already made his reputation on the New York scene. Here he was in Paris, away from his studio at the Apollo Guild, in a Paris where Richard Wright had come over. James Baldwin was on the scene. There were all these GIs. Larry Rivers was there. Herbert Gentry, the painter, had set up a jazz gallery, and a jazz gallery is a good word for it. He showed jazz and he showed paintings, and musicians and painters came in to play and hang out. Sidney Bechet had long since come to Paris and made his reputation there, and it was a real scene.
And Bearden decided to come back to New York and become a songwriter. He wrote a song called Sea Breeze for Tito Puente.
He spent 9 months in Paris, came back to New York, and then wanted more than anything else in the world to return to Paris, and thought that he could get back there by writing a hit tune. And so he talked to some friends, because musicians and songwriters were always coming up to his studio at the Apollo Guild, right next to the Apollo Theater. And he said, "Fellas, show me how to write a hit song." And so they showed him something of how to do it. There was a fellow named Fred Norman, for example, who was a composer. There was another fellow named Dave Ellis. And there was another corporation named Laertes Music, and Bearden did write some 20 tunes and became a member of ASCAP by 1954 and wrote Sea Breeze, which was actually a tune designed to sell liquor.
And of course Bearden felt the pull of the fad popularity of abstraction. There was a Chinese man, Mr. Wu, who became an important teacher for him in the mid-50s. Tell us about their relationship.
Well, Bearden met Mr. Wu only after he had come to a crisis in his life, experienced a breakdown because he was away from his art, trying to write these songs and get back to Paris, spent a short time in hospital, then met his wife, Nanette, at a fundraiser for a hurricane that had taken place down in the islands, married Nanette shortly thereafter, and then under Nanette's influence had moved away from the Apollo Guild studio in Harlem down to the studio at Canal Street, off the corner of Worcester at 357 Canal.
He was certainly a Soho pioneer, wasn't he?
He was a Soho pioneer. There were no other artists there at the time that he could remember. And there they were. Not too long afterward, his friend Norman Lewis moved downtown. But at that time, he and Nanette would go out. They'd go out to Chinatown, which is nearby. The streets closed up fairly early at night. And he met Mr. Wu, who was a bookseller, and who became a teacher of his. He set about learning the art of Chinese landscape painting from Mr. Wu.
The open corner in the upper right hand of the painting kind of brings the viewer into the piece.
Romy said that again and again, that this was one of the most important things he learned from Mr. Wu. And he also learned it from Holty. Not to close up the painting too quickly, to leave something, to leave a place for the viewer to enter.
You're listening to Art Breaking. I'm Charlie Finch here on WBAI FM 99.5. My guest is Myron Schwartzman, professor of English at Bernard Baruch College here in New York, author of Romery Bearden, His Art and Life. published by Harry Abrams. Did this association with Mr. Wu lead him to do collages? His first collages were done in what, 1960?
Well, in the midst of the 1950s, Bearden began to work in oils which he thinned out with benzene or other thinners so that they became almost translucent. And he worked in abstractions, although he would never have called himself an abstract expressionist. His work of the mid to late 1950s, which began representationally, became more and more abstract. Then, toward the end of the 1950s, he began to work with paintings in which he cut the line and thus created the foundation for a breakthrough into collage. And by 1960, 1961, I saw at his gallery, Cordier and Ekstrom, his gallery of 29 years, a very early signed collage called The Artist Center Ring. And it was in the grand tradition of collage. It showed a bicyclist on a high wire, and another acrobat climbing a ladder, and all of this over a sort of funny apartment house with windows tilted in one direction or another, and here was a signed collage, 1960-61, Romare Bearden.
Now, you've observed Romare at work. He had a very specific way of creating these collages, emphasizing the background, the kind of relationship between the figure ground. Tell us about that.
Well, Romy began to do collages on paper, and that was fine. But thereafter, he tried to do collages on canvas, and he stretched the backing so much that it broke. Later, a friend of his in Long Island City, where by now he had moved his studio, living at Canal Street but working in Long Island City and making the trip there, a friend of his named John or Jack Schindler introduced him to the idea of using a board as a backing, and he began to work on Masonite board. He then would lay in the paper, and the paper, which formed the backing for the collage, would be colored, and he thought of it as a ground for the collage itself. Later on, a famous printmaker, Robert Blackburn, who still has a printmaking workshop downtown and was himself a member of 306 much, much earlier, would give Romy rainbow-hued pieces of paper which he glued to the Masonite board or the mahogany board. And he used that as a backing which showed through and played through so that you got the effect what he called the grounds, sometimes the bolas grounds of the ancient masters, the Renaissance masters.
And Romare had huge amounts of figures that he would cut out. Would he use magazines or?
He would use a Sears catalog often enough. His wife Nanette would look through fashion magazines and cut out images. The portion of the interview we played actually resulted in a collage, and that collage has the title Childhood Memory. It shows a boy holding a rose and a blind guitar player in the midst of New York City traffic, and there's a gigantic clock in the background with an eye, and then there is a woman who's obviously cut out of a magazine, so that you had these photographic images. Very often he would cut the images so that there would be a deliberate displacement. You would get a face which was half mask and half face. There were displacements as to scale, giving you the idea that you could, it was cubist. I mean, he always saw himself as a cubist. And then he moved away from that technique, used photographic materials less and less, and began to paint the paper himself and paste it down.
In the early 60s...
And I should say also that he used fabric. He could use straw. He could use fabric. Portions of masks.
Some of his most famous pieces, in fact, use different kinds of fabric. And yet they're technically created so perfectly. He must have had strong technical problems to overcome in terms of assembling these pieces. What was it like observing him make a piece?
Well, he did not permit me to observe him make a collage. He would let me watch him draw as much as I felt like. And I certainly saw watercolors drying on the table in St. Martin when my wife Judith and son Max and I came down to visit with Nanette and Romery there. But he never let me watch him work in collage. The only person I know of he allowed to watch was the collagist he worked with toward the end of his life, Andy Thibault.
He was very influenced by the native religions in St. Martin in the West Indies, wasn't he, later in his life?
Very much so. Not that he was a superstitious man, but this was another kind of ritual. And the earliest title for his collected collages and other works from 1941 to 71 was one which Albert Murray had given called The Prevalence of Ritual, which was the title of an earlier Abrams book. But for him, this was another kind of ritual, the obeah. It was a kind of sorcery.
That's the name of the religion, the
obeah? Obeah is a religion, and also they are the names of priests and priestesses, sorcerers, sorciers.
Romery was also one of the most beautiful creators of the black female figure. He used models throughout his life. Tell us a bit about that, how he created these beautiful figures of black women.
Well, I know that he sketched in the early 40s from the model, and the models were beautiful. Although, to hear him tell it, the woman who first got him to know what he should be doing by way of painting was not beautiful at all. She was a prostitute.
Her name was Ida.
Whose name was Ida, and she met him when he and Claude McKay were coming down the stairs of the studio, an early studio at 33 West 125th Street. But soon, when he had his studio in the Apollo Guild next to the photographers, Marvin and Morgan Smith, who were also painters, he began to sketch with Sam Shaw from the model, and he had long experience in drawing and painting from the figure.
The figures in his work tend to jump out at you, almost as if they're in motion.
Oh, yes. But there's also a stillness and a stasis to them.
Do you feel that Bearden has been accepted by the art mainstream community? Of course, the Museum of Modern Art and many museums own his work, but I recall hearing Mary Schmidt Campbell give a speech 2 years ago at the Municipal Art Society in which she implored those assembled to recognize Bearden as one of the preeminent artists of this century, really synonymous with America itself. Do you feel he's received his due?
I don't feel any black artist has received his or her due. And Bearden would have been the last person to want to be thought of as a black artist and pigeonholed in that way. James Joyce would have been as angry about being called an Irish artist, although he certainly was an Irish artist. Bearden was a world figure, and I think that he made an important statement in American art possibly as important a statement as his friend Stuart Davis, a very important modernist who taught Bearden a great deal. I think that as time goes on, and all of this is permitted to be looked upon in its historical setting, Bearden will emerge as one of the very extraordinary and important artists of the latter part of this century.
And this exquisite book that you've written, Myron, I think will assist that. Are there any plans to assemble his work in the near future for a retrospective?
Well, yes. At my own college, Bernard Baruch, on 23rd Street and Lexington Avenue, we will be having a Bearden exhibition, which will open February the 8th and go into March. That's Bearden Works with Paper. And then the Studio Museum in Harlem is having a major retrospective, which will open early in April, I understand. We'll begin at the Studio Museum in Harlem, run through September, and then go to six other cities across the country. Chicago, Los Angeles, the Atlanta High Museum, and it will end in Washington, D.C. in late 1993.
Thank you very much for being our guest, Myron Schwartzman. The book you've written is entitled Romery Bearden, His Life and Art, published by Harry Abrams. And I hope on the occasion of those two shows, you can be our guest again. It was a great pleasure.
My pleasure as well, Chuck. Thank you.
You've been listening to Art Breaking here over WBAI. Myron Schwartzman, author of Romer Bearden, Art and Life, spoke with Charlie Finch. This is WBAI New York. The time is 4:27. Coming up very shortly will be Talkback with Playfell Benjamin, so please stay tuned.